This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition, our focal point is fighting fake news. Once the public sources for news and information were limited to newspapers and a relatively small number of broadcast radio and TV outlets, both network and local. But then, as the 1990s progressed and the internet grew and gained streaming capabilities, the web became a prime conduit for news coming from a far broader swath of sources. This has had two effects. The first was that the viewing, listening, reading public now had many more sources of news and information. The second effect of this transformation was the resultant growth and dissemination of misinformation, distortions, and outright lies, so-called fake news. Helping to fuel the second effect and its impact was the emergence of social media, such as Facebook, Twitter, and others, places where anyone, with or without traditional journalistic credentials, could place items and present them as proper and factual. Now we have already seen in a number of places and situations where this intentional disinformation was weaponized to improperly advance persons and causes before the public. The 2016 presidential election in the United States is one of many examples. There are deep concerns among some that the upcoming 2020 U.S. White House race may become another. In some countries, the power and impact of the internet has caused state authorities to completely shut down the web during sensitive periods such as elections and times of discord. Iran is one such example among many. With malice and misinformation rampant on the internet, what can be done to identify and discredit such attempts to sway the public in the wrong direction? That's today's discussion. Hello, I'm VOA TV senior analyst Jeffrey Young, sitting in for Encounter's regular host, Carol Castiel. With us to define and discuss the situation are two seasoned members and analysts of journalism. From the VOA London Bureau studio is Mr. Jimmy Wales, who is the CEO and co-founder of Wiki Tribune and a co-founder of Wikipedia. With me in Washington's headquarters in VOA is Dr. Margot Suska with the School of Communication at the American University in Washington. This discussion on Encounter was sparked by Jimmy Wales' article in Foreign Policy magazine called "The Internet Broke the News Industry and Can Fix It Too." In it, he states, to quote, "An important step would be to regard the online community as an active participant in the process of producing news. The key is to view social media users as a huge community of fact-checkers and news producers instead of passive recipients of unreliable news." But rather than question this myself, Dr. Suska, you read Mr. Wales' work. I want your reactions.
I would say to Jimmy, has he ever read the comments on any online article? I mean, some of them get pretty nasty. So I think that this idea of reaching audiences and engaging audiences is key moving ahead. But arming them in the new army of journalism, I don't think is key to the success of journalism in the future. I think journalism is a trade, it's a craft, it's a profession. You need trained journalists doing work to hold governments accountable in democracies. And that is only going to be done by professional journalists. I don't think that it can be done by crowdsourcing.
Jimmy, what do you think?
I think that journalism is a trade, a craft, and a profession. I think there are a great many things that only professional journalists can do. I try not to read the comments at the bottom of news stories because they are typically the worst people in humanity screaming at each other. And yet, I step back and I look at the incredible work that's been done by the Wikipedia community, which is a community that's designed in a completely different way from news comments. And I realize there are an enormous number of people of goodwill, thoughtful people, kind people, who are definitely eager and willing to step into this melee of social media and all the noise of the world and say, you know what, actually, this is not what we want. This is not what we approve of. This is something that's being pushed on us by an ecosystem that's driven algorithmically to get as many clicks as possible, to keep you addicted, to keep you outraged on social media, rather than driving traffic to quality journalisms and things that are thoughtful and, you know, analysis that's meaningful to people's lives.
I think just this week I was looking at Wikipedia with my daughter. We were looking up which song appeared on a certain Beatles album, and Wikipedia was a wonderful source for that. So I don't doubt that Wikipedia and other online platforms have a place in culture. I think the question is whether or not we're confusing information and news, whether or not we're confusing things that are nice to know, things we might want to know, with things that we need to know in order to govern ourselves in a democracy. And I think that's the distinction that I would make between a Wikipedia format and a New York Times or a Washington Post format. You're not going to get the Afghanistan papers in Wikipedia. With all of the good-meaning souls that are out there contributing, no one in the Wikipedia community, I don't think, is going to spend 3 years and lots of money fighting Freedom of Information Act and public records battles to get the American government to admit that it was wrong in spending nearly $1 trillion in Afghanistan. So I think that this idea that you're going to over-rely on some of that, I think, is harmful to the discourse of what we need to fix journalism moving ahead.
Well, I mean, I don't think anything I'm saying is harmful to the discourse, and you're not really understanding what I'm saying. I absolutely agree that we need professional journalists who have the time and the resources to go after a story that may take 3 years to fully develop. And unfortunately, in our current ecosystem, we know, and this is particularly true at the local level, these institutions, which are incredibly important for rich, healthy citizen life, are being destroyed. And even the finest journalistic institutions have been under enormous financial pressure, some of which is hopefully beginning to be alleviated now that subscriptions are beginning to take off and so forth. But there's still a very deep problem, and that problem doesn't rest with the question of the value of journalists. Journalists are incredibly important. The problem lies in a broader ecosystem that is not conducive to the spreading of quality information and is conducive to spreading misinformation, clickbait, shareable content. I can give an example here in the UK that was just this week. It's a minor incident, but I think it's illustrative. There was a photo that was shared on social media of a child on the floor of an NHS hospital. And then there was a huge noisy discussion about whether this was a true photo, was it a fake photo, what does it indicate, and so on. And there was all this obsession about the photo and figuring out, was this a mother who was an activist who had faked a photo to discredit the Tories or whatever? And what I said is, look, I don't care about this photo. What this photo is, at best, is an introduction to what we really need to know as citizens is, how's the funding going? Are hospitals in a critical shortage of beds? Turns out they are. And that's the real story. That's the story of quality. That's what we need journalists to do. Outrage around a photo shared on social media, okay, it's a thing that happens, but it's not the most helpful. What we really need is serious, thoughtful, reflective things. And we need social media that helps us to elevate those things rather than elevating just the noise of the day.
I would agree. And I think on that point, I actually think that you and I agree on that. And I think the question for me becomes moving ahead, whether or not platforms, Facebook and Twitter, are going to get more involved in terms of how they regulate or how they judge content that, you know, that gets through. And that, I think, to me, moving ahead is going to be key in 2020, with knowing how many millions, tens of millions of dollars Facebook is going to generate, not just from political ads, but also from content that gets shared, some of it fake. So I think I think platform governance is going to be a huge issue moving ahead. On that point, I agree.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, one of the things that I'm concerned about is I don't believe that the fundamental business model of the existing social networks is really conducive to them taking this problem as seriously as they should. They make money by showing you as many ads as possible, keeping you on the site as long as possible, and a certain degree of complicity in the idea of shareable content, content that outrages people, content that causes people to stay on the site longer because they're arguing and having flame wars, isn't necessarily bad for their business. And even though I do believe that there are very good people at these companies who want to do the right thing, and I'm not a person who's super cynical about Mark Zuckerberg, for example, I just think they've got a deep problem. When your business model drives you in a direction that's not consistent with the genuine interests of your users, then it's a conflict that they're going to have a very hard time resolving. It also raises, given their model, which is users have very little power, they just post whatever and they can't really control their environment, it means it's on Facebook to decide what's true or not true. And they've approached that very gingerly and very carefully. And I don't think we really want to live in a world where Mark Zuckerberg and his team decides which news we're allowed to share or not. And so it's very easy to say they should do something, because clearly they should, but it's also a bit risky if we just blindly say, you fix this problem. I think it's a deeper problem. We have to really step back and address the whole ecosystem.
But I do want to interject on this point and say that Mr. Zuckerberg has made it clear that as far as political ads go, that he will accept the political ad regardless of the content, regardless of what is being alleged in that content, regardless of whatever is purported in that content. And by providing a global platform of such major impact to people who can have benign yet can also have malicious intent, or maybe a combination of both, I think is a bit of a danger to a society that depends on at least a measure of comity and a measure of reliance upon each other to do somewhat the right thing. He feels like he has abandoned this.
Well, I agree. I think they're making a terrible business decision. I don't think that the amount of money coming from political ads, which I assume is substantial, but not by Facebook standards, is enough for them to not put a full moratorium on it and saying, look, we know there's a problem here. We're not going to take any money for any political ads until we have a way of addressing this in a thoughtful manner.
I would agree with that. And I think that what's interesting about Twitter really is that, you know, essentially Twitter is more of an echo chamber anyway than Facebook. I mean, Facebook with, you know, however many a billion people or, you know, in its revenue, reaches so many more people. Twitter tends to be more of a liberal democratic echo chamber. So I think that those two decisions were really based on their demographics rather than what was best for the political system or best for, you know, even democratic ideas. But I do think that this idea of users, and I think what's such an important point to me as a college professor and also as a parent, is media literacy moving ahead and in understanding from very young ages, I think has to be part of the curriculum in the same way that we've got to double down on understanding of civics education and the role of media, not just news media, but also social media in society. I think that we've got to get better at helping people understand some of these so that there's better transparency and understanding of the role these media play.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. I've been saying for years we need to really be doing a lot more to teach media competence, simply because, you know, for the simple reason that 50 years ago, the range of sources of information available to people were fairly narrow in comparison to today. Whereas today, you can go online and you can find everything from crazy crackpot places. You can get anti-vaccine information and sort of bury yourself in it for days and days and days. And people don't have the right skills to be able to judge, oh, when am I being misled? Or what are the things I should be assessing to make sure that I'm getting a diverse viewpoint before I make up my mind?
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Wiki Tribune CEO and co-founder and Wikipedia co-founder Jimmy Wales in our VOA London Bureau, and here in Washington, American University School of Communications, Dr. Margot Suska. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website, voanews.com/encounter. You can also follow us on Twitter at Carol Castillo VOA, or you can connect with Encounter on Facebook. Here's a big shout out for one of our listeners, Facebook follower Emeka Johnson Obata from Imo State, Nigeria. If you want to hear your own name and country on this program, send us an email to encounter@voanews.com or on Facebook, give us a like and leave us a comment. Now let's get back to the discussion on fighting fake news. Dr. Suska?
I think that one of the arguments that I've been making in media appearances and things that I've written in the last 2 years is that we need to come to a consensus about what fake news even is. Over the summer, Pew did a report, and they didn't call it fake news. They referred in their research to made-up news. So I think that as a community of academics and researchers, I think what the public thinks fake news is, they even include in that perhaps a New York Times correction as fake news. And I think that's another further part of this kind of complex, complicated ecosystem that the news media is in. But I think we need to come to some agreement on what fake news is. And I think to me as a college professor, clearly it's disinformation. It's information purposely put out to mislead the public. But I think if you were to say fake news around the Thanksgiving dinner table in Topeka, Kansas, you may have received, you know, far different responses than what academics and what thinkers on these issues, Jimmy, like you, think of as fake news. So I think we've got to come to some consensus on what it is to help us fight it. And I do work with the International Fact Check Network out of Poynter and look at some of these sites that are working on fact checking. So I know that this is a Herculean task moving ahead.
Absolutely right on all fronts there. And I find the term fake news is partly unhelpful because while we may have a shared understanding, mine would be very similar to yours, although I would include in it information that's spread with zero regard for the truth simply because it has a nice clickbait headline. Mm-hmm. Sometimes that's not intending to deceive the public. They just don't care one way or the other. They're just trying to get some fast, it's like spam emails. But other than that, we also have to grapple with the broader problems, which are low-quality media, which isn't quite fake news, but can be quite damaging. Or, for me, one of the most serious problems, and I'll tell a quick story to illustrate it, is the lack of media. So I grew up in Huntsville, Alabama, and when I was a teenager, I was a newspaper delivery boy and rode my bicycle and threw out the papers. That paper was published 7 days a week and had a competitor, the morning paper, which was 5 days a week. And the morning paper is long since dead. The afternoon paper is published 3 times a week. It's published out of Birmingham, Alabama, 100 miles away. And the last time I was there and flicked through the paper, it's basically the AP Newswire. There were very, very few local stories because there are almost no local journalists left working. And this is in a city of 250,000 people. And so in a town like that, the rise of local corruption, the lack of trust that the public has in institutions is increasing dramatically simply because we don't have journalists on the scene. We don't have journalists working in the local media. That's as big a problem. In some ways, it's an invisible problem to most people because you just don't see it. The paper's the paper, and it doesn't have local journalists, and you don't know what you're missing because the journalists weren't there to find out the stories. And yet, as compared to the problem of fake viral story online, it's really as deep or possibly deeper.
I agree with you on that point. And I think, you know, there are some moments, you know, that I almost wish to be a local corrupt politician working in America today, because what an absolute, you know, money cash grab it must be in places where there are news deserts across the United States. Mm. What I've become fascinated with and what I'll be researching for the next several months is when users, if there still is a local newspaper in communities, when users finally decide to pull the plug on their subscription because the content is just basically what they can see on CNN at night. So I think the question is going to be what kind of, I'm hopeful about nonprofit models that might be able to come in, but I don't think you're going to see the competitive atmosphere that you talked about. I grew up in Connecticut and we had a competitive marketplace there with the Hartford Current, several other smaller local papers and cities nearby. So I think there are real questions about what's going to fill the void. So in that regard, I think this idea of training community members to hold their own leaders accountable is a model that I think is one that I would be hopeful about. I think the question is, how are you going to give that person a platform moving ahead? And where are they going to be? Who are they going to reach? And how are they going to be able to do their work? And then real questions about both accuracy as well as verification. How do you know it's not just the mayor's cousin or some, you know, some of these small towns, right, trying to generate some of that work?
Or frankly, you know, my archetype story for something like this is it's a classic local story of there's a proposal to put a new road through a certain area, and there are pros and cons to it and a debate. And if you're the person covering the local city council is a fake grassroots activist who's working for the developer, that's bad. Also, if that person is a Greenpeace activist, not that there's anything wrong with being a Greenpeace activist, but probably that's also coming at it from a particular agenda that's always going to say no. Well, what we really need is a paid reporter to go in and tell us what's going on. Mm-hmm. Give us the facts. What are the arguments for? What are the arguments against? How do those stack up? And we're lacking that right now. And of course, I read a piece of yours, actually, about television. Mm-hmm. And we know that newspapers have been in financial disarray. And, you know, my hope has been, well, at least the local television, that still seems to be all right. Because I don't live in the U.S. for quite some time. It's terrible there as well. And the problem of, again, homogenization where it's not even run locally and it's a lot of cheap content.
It's interesting, you know, Sinclair, which owns 193 TV stations here, they're looking forward to 2020, not for the type of local news content that they're going to be able to produce, but I saw an executive quoted in a Pointer article who said in 2020, because of all of the money that's going to be coming in from political advertising, the quote was, in 2020, we are not going to be able to get out of the way of the money. It's literally going to be hand over fist. So again, I think that this, what 2020 is going to provide is this moment for traditional media outlets, especially in swing states, in addition to social media platforms, they're going to be getting literally tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars that are going to be coming in. But for me, as a person who studied corporate media ownership for more than a decade, I don't think any of that is going to be reinvested into local community journalism. And that's the sad fact. So, you know, there have been some exchanges. I've been at events recently, one with the Knight Foundation, where they were talking about whether or not local public radio stations can operate in these. People have talked about low power FM coming in and maybe serving some of these local communities. But I think that we need to start looking at maybe these opportunities for smaller markets, right? I mean, maybe you're reaching 10,000 people as opposed to what Walter Cronkite did. But I think for me, what I'm really interested in studying this, when people turn off their subscriptions or cut off their subscriptions, if they would be willing to redirect that money to other models. That's what I'm really interested in looking at, and to see where that might go or where they might take even that $100 a year or $200 a year, where would they be willing to put it? And that's what I'm hoping to carve out, some idea of where we might be able to redirect some of those funds in the future.
Yeah, the positive signs I see here are, you know, obviously, I think we're all happy that the New York Times digital subscriptions have done very, very well. They've gone from 1 million to over 4 million in the last few years. But of course, that's the New York Times. So that's a broad national newspaper. I don't know of any local papers that have managed to pull off anything similar. But we also, I'm optimistic about one of the major newspapers here in London. I met with the digital people there, and they said they're having success with subscriptions from millennials. And I said, oh, wow, I was surprised to hear that, because also this paper is really kind of has an old-fashioned brand, and I thought, I didn't even know millennials read your paper. And the answer was they are now a generation that is used to the idea of paying for Netflix and paying for Spotify and paying for Hulu. Instead of expecting to get everything for free, they understand that if it's free, it's all a bit of a mess, and you can pay for something of quality, and it's a nicer experience. And I said, well, I hope you're right. I think that's really interesting, because then that does give some hope that as people are canceling their local newspaper subscriptions because the local newspaper sucks, basically. I mean, if all you're running is the National Newswire, that's all over the internet for free, that either new entrepreneurial models will arise or some of those papers will wake up and realize, actually, there is an opportunity here. People will pay us and subscribe, but only if we deliver a product that's meaningful to them. So there is maybe some hope along those lines.
In the UK, The Guardian. I read The Guardian every day, and everything that I read in The Guardian at the bottom of the piece will say, The Guardian, by the way, would very much like to have a contribution from you. Would you be so kind as to kick in a couple of bucks so we can keep this going? That's something that I also noticed that Wiki likes to do. When I go and look at something at Wiki, you like to put a banner up at the top and say, oh, by the way, we would much appreciate if you would put a couple of quid in an envelope and send it to us. Okay.
Yeah.
And I understand this, but is this a viable business model?
I was on the board of The Guardian a few years back when they started doing that, and I don't take any credit for it. They had all the ideas, but I take a little of the blame because I cheered them on. And I said, you know, look, at that time, their membership model was all about you can get a tote bag or discount kind of museum admissions and that sort of thing. And I said, look, people want to support The Guardian. They love The Guardian. They want to support The Guardian. So just ask for money like we do at Wikipedia. And it's been very successful. They went from losing 80 million to 100 million a year to recently posting a very slim, but hey, it's an operating profit. And that is largely because of the reader revenue increases. It is also due to cost cutting and so on. So it's not a completely ideal answer. But, you know, it does feel like the public is eager to support quality media, and we just need to figure out ways of making that happen.
This is indeed a time to be aware, to be wary, and to challenge what news and information may be put before us. My thanks to Mr. Jimmy Wales in the VOA London studios and to Dr. Margot Suska with me here at VOA Washington. Sitting in for Encounter's regular host, Carol Castiel, this is VOA TV's senior analyst, Jeffrey Young. Join us next week for another edition of VOA Encounter.